here on BBC Radio 4, it's time for Last Word.
Now, Professor Janet D. Rowley was the biomedical researcher who demonstrated that cancer is a genetic disease. The British geneticist, Dr. Emily Grossman.
What she did is that until that point, the chromosomes in one of the forms of leukemia called chronic myelogenous leukemia had been discovered previously by two scientists in America, that of the 46 chromosomes in each cell, in patients with this form of leukemia, one of the chromosomes, chromosome 22, was really tiny, kind of a mini form, but they didn't know why or what had caused it. So she used a new technique in the 70s called banding to actually look at the picture of the chromosomes under a microscope. And she could see from this banding pattern that the small chromosome 22 had actually got the end of it chopped off and it had switched places with the end of chromosome 9. So it's kind of like if you've got two pencils, a red one and a blue one, you break the end off both and you switch them round. So what that meant was that there had been a genetic switch or a change, which is called a translocation. And this was really crucial because it was the first time that a genetic basis to cancer had been discovered or shown. So it meant that the genes from the two chromosomes were in the wrong place, which was what was causing the cancer. And this revolutionised our understanding of cancer as a genetic disease.
Good morning. It's an issue that has perplexed education chiefs and ministers down the decades. Just how do we interest more women in science? Entice more girls to keep studying science into sixth form and beyond? Convince the female student that there's a future for her in a science-based career? Here to talk about this are four successful women scientists who are going to introduce themselves.
I'm Dr. Emily Sidoni Grossman. I'm a science teacher. I actually had a student who came to me, a female student, who said that she had told her teachers at school that she wanted to do A-level science. And they had said, oh, go and do biology then, because physics and maths are for boys. And with that prejudice, I think coupled with the fact that women have been shown to systematically underestimate their own abilities and to attribute their success to other external factors. And within a male environment, if they haven't got the support of female role models, female teachers to encourage them, it can be really difficult for girls to take on those so-seeming tougher subjects and feel confident. And I think a lot of girls don't realise that science careers can actually be really creative. Mm-hmm. So I teach a lot of girls who come to me and say, oh, I'm a bit arty, I don't really do science because they do drama or singing. And I think there's a lack of awareness of what science careers actually involve and how really beautiful and creative doing experiments and finding results. It's kind of akin to gardening or cooking or painting, where you're putting things together and making a new experiment, a new result, and finding really exciting things. And it's up to careers advisors to tell students from a young age, as you say, the opportunities that are available to them as scientists. People think of scientists as people sitting in a dark room in a lab coat with their hair tied back and goggles on, which, you know, sometimes is the case. But there's all
with
sorts of exciting scientists.
You know, with steam coming off it.
But the reality is that they could be doing amazing things like pharmacology, making drugs, or pathology, or forensics, or building spaceships, or working in the pit of a Formula One racetrack. And all of these careers are just not known about because of careers advice and also lack of presence in the public eye and presenting and media.
You studied molecular biology, but your science has led you into teaching, tutoring. Mm-hmm. And amongst your many testimonials, there is one that I thought was really interesting, which says, I went to college to learn science, I came to Emily to understand it. I want somebody to say something like that about me. That's just amazing. Do many students leave science education without that necessary understanding?
I think that's absolutely right. I teach a lot of students doing A-level biology who never really understood the difference between a chromosome, DNA and a gene, or who are studying A-level physics and they don't really get how electricity works. And I think that goes on into further education, where there's a lack of the basics, the real building blocks of sciences, because there's a lot of shortcuts taken at schools give them kind of little cheat techniques to pass the exams. And when students come to me, I always say, right, we're going back to the beginning, we're going back to year 7 if necessary, and building it up from the bottom. They're like, oh, but I just want to pass the exam. And I'm like, I promise you it'll be easier. And they do. They really do, and they thank me, and they say, okay, it's suddenly so easy because it all makes sense. I don't have to worry about learning 56 equations because I can learn one and work them all out from there, because I get what's going on. And for me, that's what is really important.
Frederick Sanger was the only Briton to win the Nobel Prize twice. Dr. Emily Grossman is an expert in molecular biology.
Proteins were thought of as just this sort of amorphous lump or blob, and no one really knew anything about their chemical structure, or indeed if they had a chemical structure. But what he did is he found a method of determining the exact amino acid sequence of proteins. So proteins are made up of amino acids. And he took the protein insulin and he chopped it up into pieces. And he used those pieces to determine how the amino acids fitted together, in which order. And what he found, which was really remarkable at this time, was that there was indeed a precise order. So insulin had an exact determined chemical structure. And by extension, he was able to conclude that all proteins did indeed have a distinct linear sequence, which was unique to them.
And what was the implication of that?
Well, the implication was that a little bit later on, Francis Crick came along with his sequence hypothesis.
So then came the second Nobel Prize. What was that for?
He then started working on not the sequence of proteins, but the sequence of DNA itself, and how to determine the precise A's, T's, G's and C's that make up a particular piece of DNA. And he came up with this remarkable technique for doing exactly that. And he was able to use this technique to determine the precise order of bases in a stretch of DNA, hundreds and then building up thousands of pieces long. And that technique, called DNA sequencing, which is now called the Sanger method after him, was the method that was used in the sequencing of the Human Genome Project, when in 2003 we got a complete readout of the entire human genome.
This is hugely significant, yeah. Isn't it? It's a revolutionary piece of work.
Absolutely. Because by knowing the human genome, which took an awful long time, we now have a reference library to look at anyone's genome. So it's opening up this enormous area of research into diseases, heart disease, cancer. It's been expanding massively over the last 10 years since the Human Genome Project was finished, but particularly faster and faster now for personalised treatments for those particularly nasty diseases.
Do you teach this stuff now to young people?
I do. But what I find remarkable is now it's a page in the textbook, the Sanger method, finding out the sequence of genes. It's something that everybody just knows now. It's something that's really routinely taught, like algebra.